Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi So, and when I first came to Britain, and I was talking with Ajahn Sumedho, and he'd been a bhikkhu for 12 years, and I thought, well, he's been meditating all this time and he still has to do it. He can't have got very far, can he? Surely you should be able to just kind of do a few months of it and you've learned it, and that's the end of it. And why do you have to keep doing it? Myself, I thought probably a few months would be enough to get it all sorted out and then go on to chapter 2, or the next bit. But with practice you begin to really understand why it's a dynamic process. Dhamma, living Dhamma, is a dynamic process. You're always meeting the moment, the new moment, though it never really finishes. You're meeting the new moment, the moment that arises, when it's dependent upon external conditions such as people around you, situations in your life, busyness, quietness, distress, dependent on external circumstances, all these internal processes, emotional things, the way that we sense ourselves. Always meeting that. So it's things arising. As they arise, they can either crystallize into self and the world, where there's always some kind of precarious balance of how I get on and what I have to hold on to and what will be the future for me and what will other people think and things like that. As things arise, they either crystallize in that way where we feel slightly tense, anxious, fixed or hardened in some way, or as they arise they can be released, where the result is a quality of lightness, joyfulness, fluency, brightness, compassion, kindness. These kinds of things are what accompany the release of conditions. When conditions arise and they're not held, the release of them is happy, blissful. It gives us clarity. That's the result. You can discern. So living in this way, you're always living at that edge of things arising. Which way is it going to go? That's why it never ends. As long as there's arising. Everything's a test to see what you'll do. Which way it's going to affect you. When you hold, if something holds on or something releases. And you can find all kinds of patterns that you can recognize and ways of remembering when we hold on, when the holding on occurs, associated with fear, anxiety, what will happen if, will I be overwhelmed, will I be hurt, will I be abused, whether it's gain, loss, praise, blame, happiness, unhappiness, renown and ignominy. These are called the worldly winds, and these are things, these winds arising, these kind of senses make the whole thing more tricky and precarious. Which way is it going to go? This is called the world. Will I be able to tighten up and crystallize into something that's pleasant, fortunate, or will I end up stuck with something that's difficult, painful, humiliating? I defend myself if I can skip that one, if I can duck out of that one, if I can do a deal here, if I can, you know, these are the kinds of twitches that happen in the heart. Keep us busy, don't they? And the end result of this not quite managing that edge is a slightly restless dis-ease, dukkha, where you don't feel really settled and calm and comfortable in your space. You feel there's something you've got to hold on to, something you've got to prepare, an escape route you've got to have planned, strategies, some way of getting out, some way of getting a little happy bit somewhere, you know. And our lives are often strategized around these kinds of experiences. You've got little safe places and little pleasure places and little tokens of esteem kind of within arm's reach for when the stuff hits, and you quick get one of those, go and see so-and-so, switch on that, you know. These are the kind of things that happen in subtle ways and not so subtle ways. And it's difficult to really let go of those, because they do provide a kind of an insurance. These can be quite subtle effects of, can I turn a deaf ear to that one? Yeah, that gets me off it. Just going to not hear that bit. So some of the uncomfortable things that come up, we can cock a deafen at, as they say, turn a blind eye to, or it's somebody else's problem. That can also take us away. So there's a kind of selective numbness, selective deafness. Views and opinions, we can get, these can help. Sometimes a mind jumps to those. Shouldn't be this way, should be that way. Rather, so we can go into something that feels righteous or gives us a sense of confidence, gives us some sense of stability. We've got a view and opinion about the way things should be. And we don't have to really acknowledge the uncomfortable sense of really not having ground in this world. It is a risky place. It is a teetering kind of place. And the instinctive nature wants to jump and hold the secure place, the safe place, the place where I won't be got at or bothered or dragged out or revealed. Hurt in some way. So in fact, this is so instinctive. It's not a voluntary or a personal matter. It's not that bad people do it and good people don't do it. It's in there, you know. It's genetic, it's hormonal, it's a nervous system does that. You know, you poke a body and it twitches and it tightens. You fall over and the body braces against that. You're sitting in your car and snow on the bonnet of the car comes against, splashes up against the windscreen, you blink. You know there's glass there, still your body does that, it tenses up. Somebody shouts and you feel yourself jump. It's not this tightening is not a voluntary thing. It's an instinctive thing. Save me, let me not be hurt. And that happens even when the body itself is not threatened. You can feel that same effect. And so the shouting or people saying abusive things, you feel your body tightens up. Nothing's affecting your body, it's affecting the heart or the mind. Your body just receives that message, this is not safe, and it tightens up. And it can be this when you begin to contemplate this effect, just as an effect, not as a personal statement. And how we can, what do we need? What's needed for that to come out of this? Is it this state? And to recognize it is not just unpleasant, sometimes it's actually quite pleasant, when you get locked into something that's got some boost in it. It's pleasant at the time being. But we're trapped, we're not agile, we're not loose, we're not free. There's no space. We're on track with something. We're actually out of control. We're actually hooked onto something that's carrying. And this is even the case when we've locked into something that's happy and buoyant and pleasant. When you lock into it, one doesn't want to let go of it. Wants to be in that and cruise on that. And then of course if it's this if that cruise is terminated, we feel disappointed and irritated. So you see how the pleasantness of holding on is actually unsatisfactory, and yet we still do it. We must have been through this 1,000 times, and even when one receives teaching on it, one still does it, but in perhaps more subtle ways. Holding on to spiritual ideas or religious views, holding on to privacy in private places, holding on to states of mind, holding on to little bits of status of some kind. So letting go is actually a very demanding practice, the real letting go. Because it has to go against those instincts. Perhaps first of all we learn to let go of the idea that we don't have those instincts. We stop pretending. We stop deceiving ourselves. That's great. Even that much is really great. That's a bit of letting go. So then you're prepared to attend to the anxiety or the panic or the holding on or the shutting down. What is this? What's happening? And you see that actually letting go requires holding. Not exactly holding on, but holding or being held. Yeah, held with awareness. Held with tenderness, held with patience, held with this beautiful firmness that's not savage or harsh, and just held carefully. And in the holding carefully, holding tenderly, holding clarity, something in us starts to feel that, and we begin to relax. Like coming out of panic, just like as if somebody's just putting their hand on your shoulder when you're in some kind of panicking state, and you can just feel that steady presence in you, not judging, not being judged, not being told to snap out of it, but you've got something to navigate towards, some sense can navigate towards that steadiness, that gentleness, and you come out of the trap, out of the trance. It's almost something, you know, this is occurring through your nerve endings, not just as an idea. Letting go requires holding. Being held is why we take refuge. To be homeless, you have to have a refuge. And homelessness really, at the deepest level, means you haven't got not finding a place in the world, in these worldly winds. So as a moment-by-moment practice, it's not, homelessness is about not establishing a fixed place in accordance with these worldly winds. Not pitching one's tent on gain or loss. And that is why the basic Buddhist practice is about refuge, and more than an act of faith, a real increasing ability to get a sense of that, where we feel held without being shut down, where you feel comfortable, where you feel allowed, where your madness is allowed to be, where you can, the panic and the madness, the anxiety can actually receive something that here, this is this. You don't have to be in that, there's this. So it's not a letting go into nothing. It's sometimes called the deathless element or the nirvana element. And it gives you, that very phrase gives you a sense of something substantial. Even though there's no substance, but it gives you the sense it's not about vacuity or hollowness or just dropping out. There's some presence that you feel you can release yourself into. Otherwise, you actually don't release. What we do when we don't have that refuge is we bounce. We bounce and deflect and ricochet. So we either, something difficult happens and our mind jumps the other way, or it blocks it, or it pretends it hasn't happening, goes somewhere else, shuts down, or hardens up, throws it back, defensive behaviour. We can get quite aggressive. Not necessarily a physical way, but snappy, tetchy, snarly, short, dismissive, mental, emotional aggression, blaming, criticizing, snapping, snarling, sniping. And so you feel some bristling physically, a heat coming up in the body. It It's that instinctive. So, you know, letting go goes past that. So if you're just letting go by dismissing something, that's not letting go. If you're letting go by shrugging it off, that's not letting go. If you're letting go by shutting down and not attending to something, that's not letting go. I'll let it go. Dump means I've forgotten it. That's not letting go. That just means ignoring it, forgetting it, dumping it, shrugging it off. That's just one of the fundamental ways of defending oneself, to shrug. You know, your problem. You know. So we may call it, I've let go of my concern with that. I've let go of being responsible for that. But that's, you know, a turtle does that, a tortoise does that. There's nothing particularly skillful about that kind of letting go. Anybody can do that. Real letting go is accompanied by something in our hope, in our instinct relaxes. The instinct can be hope, wish, desire for security, desire for knowing the future, desire to get things fixed, desire for progress. You know, something that relaxes, and we recognize that progress and security are not needed. Because that letting go is into that which has no progress. It doesn't need progress. It doesn't need security because it stands in its own confidence, its own assurance. It's awareness, a deathless element. These are terms that can be helped to indicate this is known, talked about, referred to by the Buddha. You know it for yourself. Letting go, that kind of letting go is accompanied by risk, by a feeling of edge, going, is it possible? Oh well, you know, giving up, relinquishment, and then the relief and the release. Relief and release from ourself. Remember when I broke my arm a few years ago? Now I was going to a physiotherapist to get this arm fixed, and I had to do various when they actually, you know, got the bone stuck, knitted together again, and all the muscles needed to be built up again, and the whole shoulder had to learn what it was and how to operate, because it had been, the bone had been broken, so the thing had been in plaster for several weeks. So I had to go to physio, and things like lifting a weight up and putting it down, just to get the arm, the shoulder to function properly. And the physiotherapist told me, well, actually picking things up is much easier than putting them down. You know, the muscles that are required to actually let the arm come down are far more complex and evolved and intelligent than the ones for picking up. Picking up is easy, letting it down is difficult. Because letting it down means a gradual relaxing and releasing. And in that there's always that the body has to sense, is it safe, is it okay? The speed of letting go, because if you let go of your arm, suddenly it can hit something. If it's in pain, it might get damaged. It might drop the thing you're trying to put down carefully. So the whole sensitivity to putting something down is actually much more finely attuned than to just picking something up. I remembered that. because that's what letting go is like. It's much more subtle and intelligent than holding on. Holding on is instinctive. Letting go is not instinctive. It's not a shrug. It's not a gimmick. It's not a strategy. It requires sustained awareness. We might say that it's like the qualities of faith, saddha, virya, energy, particular kind of energy, sati, mindfulness, that which brings us into the present, samadhi, or that focus, concentration, and panya, or discernment. These are the attributes, the things that hold the letting go. They moderate it. I mean, there's a without that, we don't let go, we just conk out, or collapse, or dump. And there's no profit, there's no benefit in that. When you cultivate a letting go in meditation, as you all know, it requires a lot. Meditation is about being very present in your body, aware of your body, having the body balanced. So the body is held in a poised way, but it's held in quite a careful way, so there's not a tremendous amount of muscular effort required, just finding the balance where the body will sit. And then the very processes of the body support it, like the breathing. Actually, the full breathing regulates the bodily posture. You know, breathing in tones you up and lifts, breathing out relaxes. And that continuing steady presence acts as a core presence around which the body's energies begin to revitalize and form a subtle shape. So you begin to sense the subtle form of the body, the energetic form of the body, and then your awareness tunes to that, so that the physical form acts as a place where this subtle form arises. And as your awareness attunes to that, the physiological effects and the effects of attention begin to blend, and you get this sense of the mind, body, you know, blending together into something that has a certain holding power. And it holds... essentially, it has a comforting, steadying effect. So it very much holds and comforts and stabilizes the heart, or the citta, where the emotional and reactive and reflexive energies occur. And jump, twitch, collapse, our jangle is in the citta, the heart. The thinking mind, you know, cooks up the topics and the reasons about that, but the actual business of that is in the heart. And you can't let go of the emotions through thought. You can't let go of that. You can't relax the emotional stuff, the jangle, the busyness, the tension, the stress, the agitation, just by a thought. So it's very frustrating when you recognize as an idea that you should be calm and don't worry about that now and just release that and let go of that, and it doesn't happen. You know? So if you try to approach it from this be this way, don't be that way thinking, judgmental mind, what happens is you don't actually let go, but one creates a lot of judgments about busyness, you should be quiet, you should shut up, you should be brave, you should be happy, you should be courageous, you should be... And that forms another kind of a pattern of distress. It's heartless, isn't it? There's no refuge in that, telling you where you should be. There's no refuge. So the heart finds refuge in the body. Not this, just the physical form, but this subtle body where you feel the nerves release and relax, where you feel a sense of steadiness and comfort. But in meditation, being held by that is a place where the heart comes out of its panic. And a lot of the panic is just the basic sense that the heart has of being abandoned. You know, you're out here, help. There's stuff happening, help. It's like a frightened chicken running around. And just rushing after it with a hatchet, threatening to cut its head off to make it go quiet, doesn't calm the little beast down. Just squawks and rushes, and then maybe he hides somewhere. And the hidden heart is a terrible thing to live with. Your heart has gone numb, hidden, frightened to come out. Who wants to live with that? And yet that can be the choice. Just, you know, don't feel anything, shut down. It's safe, but it's joyless and lifeless. So how can the heart be present? Unless it's with these conditions arising and these pain and loss and so forth, except there's something that holds it. And we can say hold it with awareness, but awareness that has been enriched through the process of meditation to have a strong tone, a strong comfortable tone. This is what the body grants it. This is the bodily contribution to the whole phenomenon, experience of awareness. It's very important. The Buddha said, you don't taste the deathless unless you have mindfulness of the body. The deathless is lost on those who have no mindfulness of the body. That's a pretty clear statement, isn't it? This deathless element, that which can hold you, is not present if there's no mindfulness of the body. So sometimes I liken this hold to being the way one would hold a bird, you know, both hands, cupped hands. And you're holding it in a way that is to protect it, to give it a place to sit. You don't want anything out of it. And you hold the whole thing. You know, you just hold a bird by one leg. That doesn't make it feel very comfortable. You just hold it by the beak or the neck. You have to hold the whole thing. And it's rather like that, feeling the whole body, the whole sense of that, what it is to be embodied, and then the heart, the whole of it. If you get just trying to pick one little feature and hold on to that, it's rather like holding a bird by the tail or the wing, the rest of it flaps and flutters, and you have to grip it very hard. You hold the whole thing, and it's a certain distance is required, a certain spaciousness is required to get that sense of the whole thing. It's not a picking away at particular, you know, features, but just, you know, what it feels like. So you get the sense, what it feels like to feel busy, what it feels like to feel scrambled, what it feels like to feel, you know, resentment, or what it feels like to feel bubbling, or whatever it is. You just get the whole sense of that, because it, and just to feel it, it's not to make a judgment out of it, because the holding is that. It's not judgmental. There's no need to add anything more to it. That's the simplicity of it. That's the simplicity of the mindfulness process. It's just, one is aware, this is the heart affected by fear or joy. And the very quality of this awareness, this embodied awareness, has a steadying effect in its own right. And give it some time. The bird flutters and squawks for a while and, you know, scrambles, and it begins to feel comfortable, feel that what's around it is benevolent and comfortable. And it, oh, settles down. So if you hold it, you may first feel the whole form, then you can feel the pulse, then you might feel, then as you hold it more closely or carefully, you feel the warmth. You may feel the softness of the feathers. So it's a very fine kind of holding, and it's sensitive. It's like this. And as you do that, as you hold some of the difficult things in your life, first of all, you must may feel the tremendous pushing and tumult of it. And this is like the movements of the bird. And as you hold that carefully, it begins to calm down, and you feel, oh, there's something else here. There's the life in it, the heartbeat, and the softness of it. So that we begin to recognize, you know, our unskillful mental states arise from a heart that is basically comfortable, but it gets panicked, it gets thrown. But you can't cut that out, you can't crush it, and you kill the thing. So that's the kind of holding. And doing it thoroughly, do you feel how, you know, the anger, whatever it is, turns into something like the need to defend. As you hold that more carefully, you feel how the need to defend comes from a place of fear of being overwhelmed, fear of, or being rejected or overlooked. You keep holding that, and you feel the sense of, underneath the fear, the grief, and sadness. And holding that, you feel underneath that the tenderness, the sweetness. So you can feel in through these patterns how our rage comes out of tenderness that's lost. There's a huge amount of that in our lives. Loss of heart contact. So when you meditate, it's rather like this. And the faith is to recognize that this is enough. You know, you have to trust it. This is enough. The mindfulness is just to stay with this. Keep being present with this. The energy is what requires to keep holding the mind from running into something else and directing it back to this. The concentration is staying with it, sustaining power. And the discernment is to keep listening in and understanding the patterns that arise as they arise. Understanding them as impermanent, changing, understanding them as selfless. It is like this. This is the way that the world dissolves back into the heart. The hardness relaxes. There's something luminous and bright. When you begin to understand that being held doesn't mean being throttled, being held doesn't mean being trapped, being held doesn't mean being judged, being held doesn't mean losing freedom, but if you're held with awareness, it means the possibility to come out, to be released, to let go, then it really supports the way the ones understands one's daily life, how we can be held by conventions, by precepts, by responsibilities, by relationships, without holding on to them or being trapped in them. And this is in our lives, our daily lives. This is a further skill, and a skill that complements and deepens meditation. When am I holding on to a position, and when am I resting in it, aware of it, aware of a function or a job or a task, and looking at or understanding my fears or panics or worries or pride, and relaxing those. This is just the thing we do. This is just the thing we do. This is for the welfare of others. This is just something provide the four requisites. This is just something to tidy the place up. It's nothing more than that. You know? So getting a sense of the appropriateness of one's conventional life, how it fits, is very helpful, because then that becomes a refuge. If you don't focus on conventional life, it tugs you back into the world through the worldly winds again, by dismissing it, rejecting it, or seeking something in it. Actually, it's just like this. On one level, we live in the world. We live with places to, we need shelter, we need requisites, we need food, we need clothes. Just on that level alone, we need medicines. We need people. We need people, you know, at least. You know, you're born, you need a person, the helpless, sprawling tyke. You need something to get you into shape. As you grow up, you need people to understand how things are done, what's appropriate, who am I. As you get older, you need people to help you out. As you get very old, you need people. As you die, you need people. You know, who looks after you when you're falling apart? People. It's important to get that sense of it right. It doesn't mean, you know, grasping at, but a sense of the blessedness of other human beings. How we can sense them in that way. You're not asking people to prop up your personality. But the way of relationship, whereby you respect and kindness for another person, because that's a person. That's what I am, you know. So Sometimes the holding in conventions is called sangvara, or which means restraint or being held. But it is essentially a kind of something that steadies and comforts. That's its aim. It's not a throttling kind of restraint. And the headings under which it comes are also useful to remember. It's called the sangvara, the Patimokkha Sangvara, which is the restraint in accordance with what in monastic terms is called the monastic discipline. But when you begin to understand the monastic discipline, you see it refers to behavior, right? Non-violence, non-abusiveness, non-intoxication, non-threatening, non-manipulating, non-wheedling, non-cajoling, non-bullying, non-nagging, and things that keep you present, mindful. So it's really the Patimokkha means the kind of thing that binds your life together. It literally means the thorough bond, something we hold in common. As that, those virtues and those attitudes that do not support aggression, bullying, manipulation, wheedling, manipulating, anything of this nature. And they help us to live with a certain sense of dignity and respect. Being held within that. Being held within that. When I'm held within that, I feel upright. I feel I'm here. And from that place I start to see other people in that way, with respect. In conventional terms, it's the Patimokkha is the thing that connects, makes it comfortable for the summoners and the lay people. It provides their sense of relationship. It provides a relationship between the male and the female monastics, between the junior and the senior. So there's a sense of things that give rise to non-aggression, non-manipulation, non-abuse, kindness, the possibility to be able to act in trusting ways. Be held by that. Rather than, if we're not held by that, we tend to be held by power, status, flattery, appearance, things of that nature. Who's best, who's quickest, who's sharpest, who's strongest, who's prettiest, who's wittiest, who's funniest. And to take leave of that, which is quite a common, quite a strong instinct in our socialization. And so I see this as actually having a greater meaning than purely some order, some monastic order, because monastic order isn't really what it's about. This is about training oneself, picking up conventions and modes of behavior to train oneself, not to form some clique or little club, that's better than anybody else. And what's the point of that kind of thing? It creates, gives you a, makes you snooty or superior or inferior, depending where you see it, or guilty or whatever. That's, who wants that? But as a way of laying aside some of these social instincts that may have such power, and feeling this is what we're supposed to be doing, isn't it? Well, this is the way we behave, isn't it? So I remember a businessman who came to see me, and he said he determined years ago that he would only do business honestly. He would never do deals, never do anything shady in his dealings. And he'd always tell people straight how much something cost, and that was how much it cost, and there wasn't any, it didn't cost less than that or more than that, and there was no kind of shady corner cutting in it. And first of all, he lost quite a bit of business, because other people were always able to do sharper, quicker deals than him, even though eventually the you know, somebody had to pay the price of that. But then gradually he got more and more business back, because people knew this was someone they could be straight with, who'd tell them where something was. In certain part, you know, he'd kept his own practice, his own sense of worth and value present. He'd also found his customers and clients were more like friends than someone you could get something out of. But the fact that you had to determine it gives you an idea just how deep the kind of social game is that you normally, you know, bluff and and be slightly duplicitous or, you know, exaggerate. Another kind of sangha or restraint is the livelihood, which connects to this livelihood, which is appropriate, that which provides you both with the physical means and also the social means. We need both of these to be alive, don't we? There's no point in just heaping up a mass of money if you're just surrounded by paranoia and fear and anxiety and no friends. I mean, to keep alive, you want to have a whole, you know, quality to that. Restraint according to requisites, what you actually need. Recognizing there are physical needs, things we need, and just using that as something that you're clear and focused on. So this can be enormously helpful in coming out of the worldly winds, which are always wanting you to get something new or more or different or whatever. And restraint in terms of the faculties, the sense faculties, the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the thinking mind, how much we talk, what we talk about, what we see, what we read, what we look at, whether we watch television or not, what we watch. Just recognizing you can make this something that is clear and holds you, or you get caught by. Can you use that just as something that holds you in a place of dignity, steadiness, satisfaction, rather than being pulled out? And you can practice that with even just visual consciousness, you know, having the eyes open and seeing what one wants to look at or see. The eye races around, just being able to maintain openness of the senses without grasping anything in particular or shunning anything in particular. Openness of the mind without grasping anything in particular or shunning anything. So you can meditate like that. It takes you back into the whole process of meditation, the process of awareness. So these are ways that do remind us that, you know, letting go requires holding, and holding is both on the conventional level, one's life, and the more intimate level, one's heart. Externally, internally, as your life changes. So it's a continuing process, holding this, finding the balance where it becomes comfortable, settled. It takes a long while. There's so many deeply ingrained attitudes that you have to be more, have more, do more, shut up, shape up, get it together, be this, be that, don't be this, you know. You feel those, you know, and you're just sitting still, walking. You feel those things, those energies. Feel them in your body. Simplest meditation is just to feel that as you stand, walk, sit, breathing in, breathing out. Anyone?